Get you tonight to be turning to Ecclesiastes chapter 5. We're going to spend our evening together in Ecclesiastes chapter 5. But I want to begin by asking you a question, and that is this. What is it that really counts in life? If you had to sit down and write down on a piece of paper, this is what really counts in life, what really matters in life, what would you put down? You know, there are many things that we constantly are told that we must do, or ways in which we should behave if we really want to get ahead in life or get the most out of life. We get those messages all around us. If you don't have this, if you don't have that, if you're not doing this, if you're not a part of that, whatever it may be, then you just really are kind of behind in life. And in our text tonight, what Solomon does is he addresses three areas that we're going to look at, and in those three areas, he gives us some wisdom that stands in direct contradiction to what we're often told by Satan here in the world. And as we work through the chapter, what I want to encourage you to do is I want to encourage you to take the truths, and I put those kind of in quotes, that the world gives to us and compare them to what Solomon, through the inspiration of the Holy Spirit, is giving to us and see which comes out on top. What I hope that you will do is hold these truths in your own life, the real truths, what Solomon is sharing with us, and live your life according to what he says is valuable and what he says truly counts in life. So we're going to begin, first of all, in the first two or three verses. And in these first two verses specifically, what he tells us is that we need to value the God that we serve. And he begins by talking about how we approach God in our worship and in our prayers. He begins in verse 1 by saying this, "Guard your steps as you go to the house of God and draw near to listen rather than to offer the sacrifice of fools, for they do not know that they are doing evil." Folks, our worship to God is the highest service or ministry to which we can give ourselves, our worship to God. And that worship is something that has to issue from hearts that are, first of all, devoted to Him, and from wills that are submitted to His will. Not my will be done, but thine be done. And so if we're going to come to God in obedience and in worship, we've got to do so with a will and a heart that is willing to come, wanting to do what He says. Now, He begins with these words, "Guard your steps." If you're reading tonight from the King James translation, it says, "Keep thy foot." If you're reading from the New King James translation, it says, "Walk prudently." What does Solomon mean in all these? Guard your steps, keep thy foot, walk prudently. What he's saying is that we've got to be careful about the way that we approach God. And the point that Solomon is making is that you don't approach God in a casual way, as if he's just some good old friend that we're walking up to. No, God is above us. God is what we say, transcendent. He is beyond us. And He is one that we are to fear. The fear of the Lord is the beginning of wisdom. That is one of the things that Solomon would have us to understand. But in addition to telling us to guard our steps, there's something else, if you'll notice, that Solomon adds in there, and it is this, draw near to listen rather than to offer the sacrifice of fools. Draw near to listen. When he uses the word listen, he means pay attention. But also, with that paying attention, it means to obey. Do what I'm telling you to do. If you go back to the beginning of the book of Deuteronomy, actually chapter 6. Moses, it's the second law. That's where Deuteronomy gets its name from. It's the giving of that law again. Moses has the Israelites poised to cross the Jordan River into the Promised Land, though he does not get to go over. And he is once again walking with them through God's acts in their lives and everything that God has done and what they are to do and how they are to respond to God. And there in Deuteronomy chapter 6 and down in verse 3, what he says to them is this. He says, "O Israel, you should listen and be careful to do it." That's the law that he's going to give them. And in the very next verse, we have the beginning of what they call the Shema. "Hear, O Israel, the Lord our God, the Lord is one." So draw near to listen. Here Moses says, listen. He says here, we are to hear God. We are to listen to God. We are to pay attention to God with the intent of obeying Him. Solomon is saying, that's what is valuable about your approach to God. You are careful about the way you come before Him, but you also want to do what He says. You want to hear what He says. The first king that God had appointed over Israel was Saul. Saul did good until he disobeyed God concerning the Amalekites in that he did not destroy them as God had told him to do. And he brought back the best of their flocks and their herds. And because of that, God sent Samuel to him to confront him with his inobedience, or disobedience, I should say. And what Samuel says to him, it's an interesting statement he makes that we find in 1 Samuel 15, verse 22. And here's what he says. He says, to obey is better than sacrifice. Well, that word obey literally means to listen. To listen is better than sacrifice. To listen with the intent of obeying what I've been told is better than sacrifice. And Solomon here says that we're to draw near to listen rather than to offer the sacrifice of fools. What is the sacrifice of fools? It's that worship that we give to God that does not flow from an obedient heart. It's what we just kind of hand off to God as, here you go, accept it. It's the sacrifice of fools because God will not accept it. And through his prophet Isaiah, several hundred years after Moses spoke these words, we find God in the very first chapter of the book of Isaiah telling his people of Judah that he had had enough of their worthless offerings, that he hated their appointed feast. And the reason he's telling them all this, if you look down in verse 15, is because, as he says, your hands are covered with blood. You're guilty of various sins. You're not doing what I'm telling you to do. You're not listening to me with the intent of obeying. And so when we come before God, the thing that we must value is serving God in the way that God intends. But part of that valuing of God is, as Solomon brings out here, through our prayers. Notice what he says there in verse 2 and on into verse 3. He says, do not be hasty in word or impulsive in thought to bring up a matter in the presence of God. God is in heaven and you are on earth. Therefore, let your words be few. And then there's this strange verse that we find, verse 3. For the dream comes through much effort and the voice of a fool through many words. What Solomon is telling us is that we must be careful that we are not quick and impulsive when it comes to our speaking to God. We're careful in the sense that our words and our thoughts directed to God have purpose and thought behind them. When we go to Him in prayer, let me ask you a question. Let's say that you were granted an audience with the President of the United States. And you were told, as before you went in or before you were to come and speak to the President of the United States about whatever it is that you want to talk to him about, that you were going to be given a certain amount of time. You have this amount of time that you can spend with him, and then he's got a busy schedule. Someone else is coming in right behind you. Would you just go in and just start talking, or would you, before you ever go, okay, I need to make notes to myself because I want to make sure I cover these things. This is what's most important to me, and I want to make sure that I'm talking about the things that I want him to hear. I think most of us would do that. We would make sure that beforehand we knew what we were going to say, and we just didn't start talking. In his Sermon on the Mount, Jesus cautions us about the content of our prayers. There in Matthew chapter 6, verses 7 and 8, he says that when you pray, and this is the English Standard Version of it, he says, when you pray, do not heap up empty phrases as the Gentiles do, for they think that they will be heard for their many words. He says, do not be like them, for your heavenly Father knows what you need before you ask Him. God knows what we need. And so what Jesus is saying is, when you go to God in prayer, go to God with the things that you want Him to. It doesn't have to be a lengthy prayer, but it is a prayer that is specific about, here's what's important, here's what's bothering me, here's what I want you to hear. And if you look at that difficult verse there in verse 3, Solomon is actually using it as an analogy. The New American Standard, as you can see here, says, "For the dream comes through much effort." If you're reading tonight from the King James or the ESV, it says it comes from much business. The New King James says much activity, and the NIV says much care or many cares. And then he says, "In the voice of the fool through many words." What is he saying? He's saying that dreams, first of all, come as a result of much work or business or worry or cares in our lives. We're tired, we sleep, we dream constantly through the night. But he says in the same way, many words in prayer come from the voice of a fool or the speech of a fool because he's not thinking about what he's saying. As a matter of fact, Solomon had something to say about this over in Proverbs 29. There in verse 20, what Solomon said was, "Do you see a man who is hasty in his words? There's more hope for a fool than for him." Charles Spurgeon once said, "It's not the length of our prayers, but the strength of our prayers that makes the difference." The strength of our prayers. What are we praying for? What are we asking God for? The third thing that he brings out about how we value God is our vows, V-O-W-S, not the vows that we may make to a, you know, in our marriage, but the vows that we make before God to him. And here's the way he puts it. He says, "When you make a vow to God, do not be late in paying it, for he takes no delight in fools. Pay what you vow. It is better that you should not vow than that you should vow and not pay. Do not let your speech cause you to sin, and do not say in the presence of the messenger of God that it was a mistake. Why should God be angry on account of your voice and destroy the work of your hands? For in many dreams and in many words there is emptiness. Rather, fear God." Now, if you go back in Scripture, God did not require that people made vows or promises to him. No, that was something that individuals did because they wanted God to do something that they were concerned about. And so they would commit themselves to some kind of action if God would grant a specific request for them. Let me give you some examples. If you go back to Genesis chapter 28, Jacob is fleeing from his brother Esau, going back to relatives up north. Okay? He stops overnight at a place that would come to be known as Bethel. You may remember that he had a dream that night, saw the angels of God ascending and descending down from heaven. The next morning, he consecrates that place and he makes a vow. And what he says there in verse 20 is this: "If God will be with me and will keep me on this journey that I take and will give me food to eat and garments to wear, and I return to my father's house in safety, then the Lord will be my God. This stone which I have set up as a pillar will be God's house, and all that you give me I will surely give a tenth to you." You see, there's this vow. If you'll protect me, if you'll grant me safety and going and returning and bring me back safely to my father, then you will be my God and I will give you a tenth of all that I have. That's a vow. That's a promise to God that Jacob kept. Another one that you're familiar with is found over in 1 Samuel chapter 1. You may remember a woman by the name of Hannah who was childless. And Hannah, there at the tabernacle in Shiloh, prayed to God, begging for a son, and she makes a vow that we find recorded for us in verse 11. And here's what she says: "O Lord of hosts, if you will indeed look on the affliction of your maidservant and remember me and not forget your maidservant, but will give your maidservant a son, then I will give him to the Lord all the days of his life, and a razor shall never come upon his head." It's a promise. It's a vow. "God, if you will give me a son, I promise you I will give him back to you all the days of his life. And he'll be a Nazarite. A razor shall never come upon his head. Just give me a son." Well, you know that God not only gave her a son, but gave her other children as well. And you know the story of Samuel. And then there's a third one. It's actually, remember, David wanted to build the temple for God. He had collected all kinds of gold and silver and various things that were to be used in it. He had collected a lot of the construction materials that would be necessary for it. And yet the psalmist in Psalm 132 talks about David's vow to build the temple, which you may remember he did not get to build because He had blood on his hands. His son Solomon would build it. And in Psalm 132, beginning in verse 2, the psalmist speaks about this vow that he had made to God. He swore, he said, to the Lord and vowed to the Mighty One of Jacob, "Surely I will not enter my house nor lie on my bed. I will not give sleep to my eyes or slumber to my eyelids until I find a place for the Lord, a dwelling place for the Mighty One of Jacob." He wanted to do that. Now, God did not allow him to do it, as I said. So what is Solomon warning us here? He's warning us about two sins that people tend to make in making promises to God. One is that they make a vow or a promise to God with no intention of ever keeping it. In other words, they lie to God. "If you will do this for me, I'm going to do this for you." And they never have any intention of keeping the promise they're making to God. He said, that's a sin. Don't do that. The second one is they make a promise to God, a vow, but then they hope to get out of it. They try to delay it. They eventually come back and say, "Oh, it was a mistake. I didn't really mean to say that." You ever promise somebody something and then later came back and, "I really didn't mean that. I didn't mean to promise that. I can't do that." "But you promised." "I know, but I can't do it." Our kids are quick to let us know if we promise them something and if we don't fulfill it. God knows. And God hears what we say, and God holds us, folks, to our promises. So we need to value our words before God, especially when we promise God something. If providence keeps us from fulfilling a promise that we make to God, that is something He understands, and He releases us from that. But if we make a promise, we need to do everything within our power to keep it. The psalmist in Psalm 66, verses 13 and 14, makes this statement, "I shall come into your house with burnt offerings. I shall pay you my vows, which my lips uttered and my mouth spoke when I was in distress." So the psalmist was in some sort of distress and promised God, "If you will get me out of this, if you will help me," and we see that in a number of the psalms written by David, "then I will do this for you. I will worship you. I will serve you." And this psalmist is saying, "I'm coming to fulfill the vow I made." But I want you to notice the way that verse 7 is translated. First of all, I've got it here for you in the English Standard Version, and then secondly, in the NIV. In the English Standard Version, it says, "When dreams increase and words grow many, there is vanity, but God is the one you must fear." The New International Version says, "Much dreaming and many words are meaningless. Therefore, stand in awe of God." What is it that he's saying? What Solomon is saying is that fools seek to advance themselves before God with great vows and promises. "I'm going to do this. I'm going to do this for you, oh God. I'm going to serve you this way." Many words, many promises. What Solomon is saying is, you fear God. Fear God. Don't just start making words to God. Fear Him. Honor Him. In verse 8, he brings us here, kind of changes directions. I've got up here valuing the king's rule, has to do with government, if you will. And one of the things that he talks about, the basic point that he's making here, is that we shouldn't be surprised if we find corruption in high places. The way he puts it is this: if you see oppression of the poor and denial of justice and righteousness in the province, do not be shocked at the sight. For one official watches over another official, and there are higher officials over them. There are two things that Solomon says you shouldn't be surprised at if you see it. One is the oppression of the poor. It exists. It's there. The other is denial of justice and righteousness in the province. As I pointed out to you in previous weeks, this is one of the things that God, in other prophets or through the prophets, is continually condemning his people for the fact that they do not take care of their poor, and that righteousness is not maintained in the courts and among the people. Justice is not upheld. But here's what he's saying here. It's this. It's when there are many levels of government administered by many officials, some corruption is going to be inevitable. You're going to find it. If you look for it, it's there. And we might even put it another way. If enough people have the opportunity to enrich themselves by the abuse of their political power, the point Solomon is making is some are bound to succumb to the temptation. Some are going to give in to the temptation to use that power for their own benefit, for their own advancement. So he says, don't be surprised. And when you look at the last verse, verse 8, when he talks about one official watches over another and there are higher officials over them, one of two ways to interpret this. One is that there's somebody above them that will eventually catch them. Or another way to interpret it, and your commentaries or take different approaches, is that they kind of watch each out for each other. One is going to scratch the other's back. There's a network where they're going to protect one another, making it impossible to ultimately root out the corruption. But what does he say? It's this next verse that really is interesting, because he says, after all, a king who cultivates the field is an advantage to the land. What does he mean by that? Think about it for a minute. A king who cultivates the land is an advantage, or a king who cultivates the field is an advantage to the land. Solomon recognizes that abuse and corruption is inherent in any political system. I mean, it's there. You're going to find it if you look far enough. But what he is arguing is that government here, in this case, represented by the king, is still better than anarchy, where there is no rule, there is no king. Why is that true? Well, think about it for just a moment. And he's using agriculture as his example. King who cultivates the field is an advantage to the land. Think about it for just a moment. In a country where there is anarchy, where there is no king, then neither boundaries nor property rights can be maintained, unless you've got more people fighting on your side than the person trying to take the land from you has fighting on his side. And not only that, there's going to be a problem, at least in that day and time. Access to wells and other common resources cannot be fairly regulated. You go back and reread the early chapters of Genesis in the days of Abraham and then later Isaac, and what is one of the things that you encounter? You encounter Abraham having his servants dig a well, and then somebody else under another king coming and claiming that well as their own. No king over the entire land. Abraham did not have the power to enforce it, so he would pick up, move, and dig another well. Isaac would do the same thing until Abraham made a covenant with that king and his well was protected. And not only that, there is no organized resistance to ravaging armies. How do you withstand somebody, maybe a sheik, coming in that day and time with more men on his side, preventing you or driving you away or taking what's yours and destroying it? You go back and look at the period of the judges, one of the reasons they wanted a king was because of some of those very things. The Midianites, the Philistines, raiding their land. What do you find Gideon doing when you first read about him in the judges? He is threshing wheat. Where is he doing it? In a wine press. Why a wine press? Because he doesn't want the Midianites to find his wheat and take it from him. Because there's no king. No one to make sure that that is protected. So what's Solomon's point here? Government at times may be evil, but it's a necessary evil to try to protect us in some of the areas of our lives. The last section in this chapter has to do with understanding various myths, if you will, that people maintain about wealth. So here's the values that he's setting forth. What is the real truth? And I'm sharing with you, as you look here, these are the myths. The first one is that wealth brings satisfaction. But look at what Solomon says. He who loves money will not be satisfied with money, nor he who loves an abundance with its income. This too is vanity. What he's telling us is that money creates a craving, a desire for money, can create a craving in our lives that cannot be satisfied. And the person who loves money actually longs for fulfillment. And they think that they're going to find their fulfillment, and just if I can just get a little more money, I'm going to be fulfilled. I'm going to have what I want. I'm going to be satisfied. And Solomon says it doesn't work that way. And the reason that an abundance of money just leaves us with an emptiness is because of something Solomon has already said prior to this point. If you go all the way back to chapter 3, it's the fact that God has set eternity in our hearts. God has set eternity in our hearts. Our longing is for God. What satisfies the longing of our hearts is the relationship we need to have with God. It's not money. It's that relationship with God. No amount of money will ever satisfy. Paul kind of reinforced this in his first letter to Timothy, 1 Timothy chapter 6, verse 10, where he said that the love of money is a root of all sorts of evil, and some by longing for it have wandered away from the faith, and he says, pierced themselves with many griefs. Didn't satisfy. If anything, it just made them feel worse. Another myth that Solomon addresses is that money solves every problem. If I just had enough money, it would take care of all my problems. But look at what Solomon says. When good things increase, those who consume them increase. So what is the advantage to their owners except to look on? Now, folks, I think all of us would agree that a certain amount of money is needed in order to pay our bills, to keep a roof over our head, to buy our groceries, just to live in the world. We've got to have a certain amount of money if we're going to survive in this world. That being said, what Solomon is telling us is this: money in and of itself is not the magic cure-all for every problem. And then he gives us one of the exceptions, and that is new wealth creates new problems that we never knew existed before, because suddenly, according to Solomon, you're going to start finding relatives that you didn't even know you had. And friends that, well, I'm your friend, aren't I? Because you now have money. And the relative wants to take advantage of your hospitality because, can you put me up for a few nights? I need to borrow some money. You see, it creates new problems. And not only that, we suddenly realize that we owe more taxes than we used to pay because now we've got more money than we used to have. So no, money doesn't solve every problem. A third one that he brings out that we find in verse 12 is the myth is that money brings us peace of mind. But look at what Solomon says. The sleep of the laboring man is sweet, rather he eats little or much, but the abundance of the rich will not permit him to sleep. That is from the New King James. And I didn't use the New American Standard because of the word abundance. I'll tell you why here in just a minute. The New American Standard uses a different word. And I think this is more accurate. What Solomon is saying is this. It is, according to him, the common laborer sleeps better than the rich individual. Here's why. That common laborer puts in a hard day of work, physical work, exhausting work. And by the end of the day, he's exhausted. And regardless of how much he eats, he sleeps that night. Folks, years ago when I was, just before I started college, I was meeting a ride in McEwen. We had to be in Milan, Tennessee at 7 a.m., worked all day. And my job at that time was, I was what they called, you might call it a grunt. I was the one that wrecked the forms, concrete form erectors. They built the forms that pour the concrete in for ramps for the army down there. My job was to tear those forms off after the concrete set up, move them to the next location where they would reuse that, those forms, and to build more ramps. We would get through at 3:30, drive all the way back home, pick up my car in McEwen, drive all the way home. I would eat, I'd take a shower, I'd eat supper, and I'd crawl in bed, because I was tired and I had to be up at 4:30 the next morning. And I was a teenager, tired. But boy, did I sleep good. I slept good. Solomon says, however, that the rich man may also work all day. Now, his work is not physical labor typically. It may deal more with the mind, more with just things that, you know, business, if you will. But his abundance, his increased wealth brings with it something else. Increased anxiety and increased vigilance, which prevent him from sleeping well at night. Give you an example. Many of you have heard the name John D. Rockefeller. But did you know this? At the age of 53, he was the world's first billionaire. 53 years old, first billionaire in the world. He was averaging making $1 million a week. But here's the thing that you may not have known about him. At that point in time in his life, he was sick, drinking milk and eating crackers. Those were his meals. And he could not sleep. The reason he could not sleep is because he was constantly worrying. Making more money than anybody else, wealthier than any other individual on the planet. But he was constantly worrying. 53 years old. He reached a point where he started giving his money away. Philanthropy. Suddenly his health changed. It began to improve. You know, he lived to be 98 years old. He stopped worrying about the money. Just give it away. Use it for good purposes. It does not bring us peace of mind. The last thing, and he uses an illustration, if you will, but there is the idea that wealth brings us security. Look at what he uses here in verse 13. There's a grievous evil which I've seen under the sun. He uses this term grievous evil twice in this text. Grievous evil which I've seen under the sun. Riches being hoarded by their owner to his hurt when those riches were lost through a, New American Standard says, bad investment. But that term, and let me just stop there for a moment. You can see what's in the text. It's about a man, this story that Solomon is telling. It's about a man who is hoarding his riches. He says, even to his own hurt, to the point that he's causing suffering to himself, whatever that may be. He does not elaborate so that we might be able to get a better handle on it. And then he loses it all. New American Standard says, through a bad investment. The NIV and the King James says, through some misfortune. That word in the original language can go either way. It can be a bad venture, a bad investment, or it can also indicate some misfortune similar to what happened with Job. Remember when you read the book of Job? Job being the wealthiest man at that point in time, the greatest in all the East, but what happens with him? In a single day, he loses everything he has is taken from him, and his children are all killed. In this man's case, either way you go with this, because of his loss, his financial ruin, if you will, he has nothing left to leave to his son. Now, Solomon's comment here is this: as he came naked from his mother's womb, so he will return as he came. He will take nothing from the fruit of his labor that he can carry in his hand. This also is a grievous evil. Exactly as a man is born, thus he will die. Or as another translation says, just as he came, so he shall go. Solomon's saying, he can't take it with him. He's lost it all. He can't take it with him anyway. So what is it that Solomon does? He asked us a question that provokes us to think just a little bit. Down here in verse 16, he says, so what is the advantage to him who toils for the wind? What is his advantage? What has he got to show for it? And he tells us about this man. Throughout his life, he also eats in darkness with great vexation, sickness, and anger. Can't you just picture him? If he were living today, the curtains drawn on all the windows, He can't have money maybe now to turn on the electricity, so he's eating in the dark. He's angry about his situation. He's vexed about, I'll never get it back. I'll never be able to earn all that money back. I don't have that much time in my life left. What am I going to do? How could I possibly have lost it like this? Vexation. Anger. Sickness. The thing is, this man spends the rest of his days in the darkness of discouragement and defeat. So what is it when we put all of this together that we've seen in this chapter that Solomon would have us to take from it? I think it's what we find in the last three verses. Here is what I have seen to be good and fitting. What is it, Solomon? What is it that you've seen that is good and fitting? To drink and enjoy oneself and all one's labors in which he toils under the sun during the few years of his life which God has given him. What Solomon is doing is reminding us, once again, the importance of accepting our station of life. Wherever we find ourselves in life, accept it and enjoy the blessings which God has given us at wherever we are in life. And that which he tells us here is good and fitting is to labor faithfully, to enjoy the good things of life that we have, and to accept all of these things as the gracious gift of God. And in verse 19, one of the things he adds is that the ability to enjoy these blessings is also the gift of God. Furthermore, every man whom God has given riches and wealth, he has also empowered him to eat from them and to receive his reward and rejoice in his labor. This is the gift of God. Here's your key. Look at that again, and what you see is everywhere God is in it. Because you notice, if you go back, his life which God has given him, the riches which God has given and wealth that God has given, it's the gift of God. God is the one who keeps him occupied with the gladness of his heart. All of this is from God. Folks, the secret of life is our readiness to take what comes to us, whatever it may be, as heaven sent. Toil, wealth, both, all from God. God is the one that gives us. And in the very last verse, he will not often consider the years of his life because God keeps him occupied with the gladness of his heart. What Solomon is doing is he's providing us with a glimpse of this man for whom life passes swiftly, not because it's short and meaningless, but because by the grace of God, he finds his life utterly absorbing. I'm loving life. I'm living it for him. Long or short, it's in his service. It's good because he's blessing it. When we can get to that point right there, when we can get to the point where we don't consider how long I've been here, how much time I've got left, and the reason we can do that is because God keeps us occupied with the gladness of our heart, folks, we've taken a giant step forward in our lives. God keeps you occupied with the gladness of your heart. So we don't think about how old I am, what doesn't work anymore, what I've lost, because God keeps me occupied with the gladness of our heart. There's within my heart a melody, Jesus whispers sweet and low. Remember that song? Fear not, I am with thee in all of life's ebb and flow. God keeps us occupied. What about you? Is God keeping you occupied tonight with the gladness of your heart? Are you able to look at everything going on in your life and say, I'm blessed. I'm blessed beyond measure because God has given me these things, and God has blessed me, and God is keeping me, and God is guiding me. Maybe you can't say that because your life has not been given to him in obedient faith. Maybe you're a person here tonight who needs to make that change in your life so that you can know the gladness that God offers you. He wants to do that. He sent his son to die for you, to take away sin that so terribly separates you from him and burdens your life. and makes it so difficult to live. The price that he paid for you on the cross is the price necessary to take away those sins. And he calls you to come to him in obedient faith, be buried with him in baptism, and then you can rise to walk in what Paul calls newness of life. If we can help you in any way, we invite you to come tonight as together we stand and sing.